Chapter 7 Cats Together. Cats can be very affectionate, but they are choosy about the objects of their affection. This apparent fastidiousness stems from the cat's evolutionary past. Wild cats, especially males, live much of their lives with no adult company and regard most other members of their species as rivals rather than as potential colleagues. Domestication has inhibited not only the wildcat's intrinsic distrust of people, but has also tempered some of their wariness of other cats. The bond between cat and owner must have its origins in the bond between cat and cat. Such behavior has no other plausible evolutionary source. Although the cat's immediate ancestor, the wildcat, is not a social animal, adult felids of other species, such as lions, do cooperate. As such, cats of any species could possibly become more sociable in the right conditions. We may find the source of the domestic cat's affection for its owners through a brief survey of the social life of the entire cat family. Both male and female tigers are solitary, exemplifying the pattern that almost all members of the cat family, big and small alike, live alone. The females hold non-overlapping territories which they defend from one another. Each territory is large enough to provide food not just for that female, but also for the litters of cubs she rears. Young males are usually nomadic, and when they become mature, they try to set up their own large territories. These will contain far more prey than the male will ever need to satisfy his hunger, but that is not its purpose. The male is trying to achieve exclusive access to as many females as possible. Especially successful males may hold territories that overlap those of up to 7 females. Cheetah males, especially brothers, are a bit more sociable than tiger males. Female cheetahs are as solitary as female tigers, but male cheetahs sometimes band together in 2s or 3s to seduce females, many of which are migratory, as they pass nearby. Even though only one of the brothers will be the father of the resulting litter, biologists have shown that over his lifetime, each brother will father more cubs than if he had tried to attract females on his own. Male cheetahs do occasionally try to hunt together as well, but are rarely successful, apparently lacking the skills to coordinate their efforts. The best-known exception to the standard felid pattern is the lion, the only member of the cat family to have several males and several females living together. In Africa, the lion pride is usually constructed from one family of female lions, with the males originating from a different family, thereby preventing inbreeding. While still young, related males band together, sometimes adding unrelated males to swell their ranks, until their numbers are sufficient to challenge and eject the resident males from a pride. Once they have taken over the pride, they may kill all the cubs, and by doing so bring all the females into season within a few months. The males must then keep control of the pride until the females have given birth to their progeny and raised them to independence. For their part, the females not only have to raise the cubs, but they also do most of the hunting, while the males do little but protect the females from other bands of males. Thus, the superficial image of lion society as generally harmonious is something of a myth. Rather, it is the result of tension between the benefits of cooperation and competition, with each individual lion employing tactics that maximize its own breeding success. Biologists still debate why lions live in such groups. In India, lions are often solitary animals, males and females meeting only for mating. So members of this species can evidently choose whether or not to live together. Although the females in a pride generally hunt together, they do not cooperate as selflessly as their brave image suggests. If the prey is large and potentially dangerous, the more experienced females usually hold back and let the younger, more impetuous lionesses take the risks. The main benefit of numbers, and especially the presence of the fierce males, may come after the kill, when the valuable meat must be defended from other animals, particularly hyenas. Scientists once considered lions and cheetahs the only social cats, and added the domestic cat to that exclusive list only recently. It had long been clear that wherever there was a regular source of suitable food, a group of feral cats would spring up. But these groups were originally considered mere aggregations of individuals that had somehow agreed to tolerate one another, as happens when animals of many species come together to drink at a waterhole. Cat breeders also knew that their queens would sometimes suckle one another's litters, but scientists dismissed this behavior as the result of the artificial conditions under which humans usually keep pedigree cats. In the late 1970s, however, David MacDonald's documentary about cats on a farm in Devon, England, showed that this was in fact natural behavior, that free-living females, especially related females, will spontaneously cooperate to raise their kittens together. Footnote: The Curious Cat, filmed for the BBC's The World About Us series, 1979. A delightful account of the making of this film is included in its companion volume of the same title, written by Michael Allaby and Peter Crawford, London, M. Joseph, 1982. Similar studies were being conducted at roughly the same time by Jane Dards in Portsmouth Dockyard, UK, Olof Liberi in Sweden, and Masako Izawa in Japan. End of note. At the start of the study, the colony consisted of just four cats, a female, Smudge, her daughters, Pickle and Domino, and their father, Tom. When not in the farmyard, they kept to themselves. Domestic cats, unlike lions, do not hunt together, but when their visits coincided, they usually curled up together in apparent contentment. They evidently regarded the farmyard and the food and shelter it provided as theirs, since the three females would join together to drive away three other cats that lived nearby, a female, White Tip, her son Shadow, and her daughter Tab. Tom, though, was aggressive only towards Shadow, presumably regarding him as a potential rival, whereas he might need to court the two females should he lose his own pride at some point in the future. Pickle and Domino were the first to reveal how female cats come together to help one another. Early in May, Pickle produced three kittens in a nest in a straw stack. For the first couple weeks, she looked after her kittens on her own, just as any other mother cat would. Then suddenly her sister Domino appeared in the nest and gave birth to five more kittens, ably assisted by Pickle, who helped with their delivery and with cleaning them up. Then, despite their difference in ages, all eight kittens settled down together and were nursed and cared for indiscriminately by both their mothers. Sadly, all eight kittens subsequently succumbed to cat flu, a common scourge of litters born outdoors in the UK. However, when their grandmother Smudge produced a single male kitten a few weeks later, the aptly named Lucky, both Domino and Pickle helped with caring for him, including playing with him and bringing back mice they had caught, to save Smudge leaving him alone while she went out hunting for herself. Subsequent studies have revealed that such cooperation between related female cats is the rule, not the exception. I observed this in my own home, when my cat Libby gave birth to her first litter. Libby's own mother, Lucy, shared their care, grooming them and curling around them to keep them warm. Indeed, when they grew old enough to move around the house, Libby's kittens generally preferred their grandmother's company to their mother's. Cat society is based on females from the same family. In feral or farm cats, it rarely involves more than two, sisters and their kittens, or three generations, mother, daughters and kittens. However, we see little indication that the participants are consciously helping one another. Rather, many female cats, especially those with kittens, simply seem not to distinguish between their own offspring and those of other cats with whom they are already friendly. In the wild, these are most likely their own daughters or sisters, cats they have known and trusted all their lives. Some mother cats that have recently given birth will accept almost any kitten they are presented with, and some humane organizations make use of such cats as wet nurses for motherless litters. Larger colonies of feral cats usually consist of more than one family, and while these families continue to cooperate among themselves, they also compete with one another. The size of a cat colony is determined by the amount of food available on a regular basis, and where this is plentiful, for example, in a traditional fishing village where the catch is processed in situ, colonies can build up until several hundred cats are all living in close proximity to one another. Cats are prolific breeders, and numbers can grow quickly until food becomes scarce, at which point the cats on the edge of the colony will either leave or succumb to disease brought about by malnutrition. Each family group strives to monopolize the best sites for dens in which kittens can be born and to stay as close as possible to the best places to find food. However, as the most successful families grow, tensions increase among its members, even when there is enough food. Cats appear to be incapable of sustaining a large number of friendly relationships, even when all their neighbors are close relatives. Squabbles break out, and eventually some members of the family are forced out. And because all the prime space in the colony will already be occupied by other cats, they may have to find a place alongside the new arrivals on the very fringes of the colony, where pickings are slim. Cat colonies are therefore far from being well-regulated societies. Rather, they are spontaneous gatherings of cats that occur around a localized concentration of food. If the food supply is limited, a single family may monopolize it. When food is especially plentiful, several families compete for the best and biggest share, although warfare between the various clans is generally conducted through threats and careful skirting around one another, punctuated only occasionally by overt violence. In such situations, being able to call on family to assist is essential to holding on to prime territory. A female cat on her own, especially if she has kittens to feed, is unlikely to thrive. The cooperation within families that undoubtedly occurs in larger colonies is based on the same bonds of kinship that form in much smaller colonies consisting of a single family. Cats seem incapable of forming alliances between family groups, unlike, for example, some primates. Negotiation skills of this sophistication lie beyond their capabilities. Biologists are uncertain about the precise origins of these family ties. They could be accidental, caused by female cats' inability to distinguish their own kittens from others. Looking back to their wildcat ancestors, every female holds her own territory, which she defends against all other females. So the chance that two litters could ever be born in the same place is virtually zero. A female cat, wild or domestic, probably follows a simple rule of looking after all the kittens that she finds in the nest she has made. She sees no need to sniff each kitten carefully to check that it is not an interloper before settling down to nurse it. However, this is unlikely to form the sole basis for cooperation among adult cats. The thousands of generations over which domestic cats have evolved away from their wild ancestors provides enough time for more sophisticated social mechanisms to have evolved. Cat social behavior probably started to evolve as soon as humankind's invention of food storage first made concentrated sources of food available. Any cats that maintained their natural antagonism toward all members of their own species could not have exploited this new resource as efficiently as those able to recognize their relations and both give and receive help from them. Biologists distinguish two different ways in which cooperative behavior can be beneficial to both parties. One is reciprocal altruism, continuing to do favors only for those who have done favors for you. This could theoretically take place between any two animals that live near each other, irrespective of whether they were related. However, if they are related, a second reason why it would be a good idea to cooperate is kin selection. Cats that are sisters share half their genes, a much greater proportion than two unrelated female cats would. Their kittens, even if fathered by different tomcats, each share a quarter of their genes with their aunt. Thus, whichever of those kittens goes on to have kittens of his or her own, it's a sad fact of life that not all of them will, each kitten shares genes with both their mother and their aunt. Footnote. Strictly speaking, the term gene refers to a single location on a particular chromosome, and the competing versions of the same gene are alleles. One example already discussed is the blotched and striped alleles of the tabby gene. End of note. Since neither sister knows which of their offspring is most likely to survive to maturity, they should, all other things being equal, try to raise both litters. Thus, the genes that favor cooperation between cats that are, or think they are, related can flourish at the expense of rival genes that promote antagonism, even between sisters. Footnote. This is likely true, even though we know little about how such genes might work, since almost all cooperation between animals occurs between members of the same family. Genes code for proteins, and it is difficult to imagine a protein that could promote family loyalty as such. Rather, many genes must be involved, each contributing a small piece to the whole. For example, one might reduce the threshold for aggression toward other cats in general, while another enables the recognition of odors characteristic of family members through changes in the accessory olfactory bulb, the part of the brain that processes information coming from the vomeronasal organ. End of note. Reciprocal altruism and kin selection are useful mechanisms preventing selfish behavior. But cooperative behavior itself will evolve only if its benefits outweigh its costs. For the first domestic cats, the initial advantage of living in family groups would have been that the abundant food, whether prey-infesting food stores, scraps provided by people, or a mix of the two, could be shared without constant strife. However, putting several litters into one nest means that if one kitten gets sick, they all do. This can be fatal, as Domino and Pickle's experience illustrates. When in 1978, South African scientists introduced a virus to exterminate cats that were causing havoc among the ground-nesting seabirds on Marion Island in the Indian Ocean, cats that had retained their wild ancestors' habit of nesting on their own mostly survived, but family groups perished. Elsewhere, this disadvantage may be outweighed by the benefit of having several mothers on hand to protect kittens from predators. A solitary mother must leave her litter from time to time to find food, or her milk will dry up. Two or more mother cats that pool their kittens can guard them much more effectively than can a lone mother who has to leave her kittens alone in order to hunt. This benefit must outweigh the increased risk of disease wiping out the whole litter, or the ability to cooperate like this would never have evolved. Domestic cats living among humans have probably always had two main enemies, stray dogs and other cats. 20 years ago, while on holiday in a Turkish village with my wife and our youngest son, our apartment was visited by a heavily pregnant calico stray we christened Arakan. After disappearing for a couple of days, she returned, much thinner and starving hungry, so we knew that she must have given birth nearby. We found a supermarket that sold cat food, receiving puzzled looks from the cashier who seemed not to expect tourists to make such a purchase. When we followed Arakan after she ate, she disappeared into some derelict farm buildings farther up the road. After that, we fed her morning and evening until one night we were awoken by pitiful wailing. Arakan was outside our door carrying a dead kitten that showed signs of having been mauled. Arakan immediately ran off and moments later returned with another dead kitten, which she deposited alongside the first on our doorstep. A dog may conceivably have been the culprit. Small packs of latchkey dogs did roam the village in the evenings, badgering diners at outdoor restaurants for table scraps and chasing cats. If a pack of dogs found a cat's nest, they would probably dismantle it, but possibly not eat the kittens, although on one occasion I did witness a dog playing with a dead kitten. Under other circumstances, dogs have been effective predators of cats. In Australia, dingoes, originally domestic dogs gone wild, keep feral cats in check, enabling local small marsupials to thrive. Still, despite a long history and reputation for being the cat's prime nemesis, dogs were likely not to blame for these kittens' deaths. Because Arakan's loss occurred at night, The culprit was more likely another cat, the dogs having returned to their owners' homes at dusk. Infanticide is a regular occurrence in lions, but only a few instances have been documented in domestic cats. Male lions kill cubs that are not their own, because doing so brings the mother lion back into season almost immediately. Otherwise, the males must endure a 19-month interval between births, and by that time, those males might have lost control of the females. Female cats are often ready to mate as soon as their kittens are weaned, or earlier if they do not survive infancy. So the intruding male cats that have carried out all recorded instances of infanticide probably gained little from their cruel act, at least in terms of increasing their opportunities for mating. Infanticide appears to be most common in small, single-family cat colonies on farms, rather than, perhaps surprisingly, in the large, multi-group colonies where aggression is much more generally evident. In those larger colonies, females often mate with more than one male, thereby making it much more difficult for those males to work out which kittens are theirs and which are not. In this way, males should kill only the kittens of females they can be sure they have never met before. If the mother is present, she defends her kittens with all her might, so males are wise to target unguarded litters. A pooled litter with two or more females in attendance will be better protected against marauding males than litters kept in separate nests, even though they are less well isolated from infections. Perhaps the unfortunate Arakan had no surviving sisters with whom she could have joined forces. Family life provides opportunities for cats to learn from one another, rather than working everything out for themselves. As we have seen, mother cats instruct their kittens on how to handle prey by bringing it back to them. We have no evidence that she actively teaches them. She simply provides them with opportunities to learn what prey is like, but in the safe environment of the nest. Also, although kittens naturally pay great attention to everything their mothers do, it is unlikely that they deliberately imitate her. True imitation involves complex mental processes. The animal must first know what the relevant actions are, and then translate what it has seen into movements of its own muscles. Because we ourselves find it easy to imitate, we tend to assume that other animals can do the same. But research indicates that true imitation, deliberate copying of another animal's actions, may be restricted to primates. We know of simpler ways that kittens learn from their mothers without directly imitating her actions. Instead, the mother draws the kitten's attention to an appropriate target, and they then direct their own instinctive behavior toward it. In a 1967 experiment, scientists demonstrated that mothers teach their kittens best when challenging them to perform an arbitrary task to get food. The experiment consisted of allowing a kitten to explore a box that had a lever sticking out of one wall. The kitten would usually ignore the lever, apart from giving it a sniff, unless it had watched its mother pawing the lever and being rewarded with food, in which case it paid great attention to the lever and quickly learned that pawing it produced a reward. Usually kittens will spontaneously pat an object that moves, but only rarely pat something that appears inanimate and fixed. As other experiments have shown, that both mother and kitten ended up pawing the lever was probably not due to direct imitation. The lever was designed to work best when pawed, but instead to the kitten's realization that the lever it had seen its mother manipulating looked the same as the one in its own box, and was therefore something it should investigate closely. Kittens invariably use their paws to investigate something novel, so they didn't need to imitate their mother's actions, they simply did what came naturally. In a similar experiment, other kittens were allowed to watch unfamiliar female cats performing the task. These kittens either took a long time to learn to paw the lever or didn't learn it at all, showing that it is specifically the mother that kittens feel comfortable watching. They are probably just too inhibited by the presence of an unfamiliar adult cat to learn anything. Mother cats can pass some of their hard-won expertise onto their kittens by providing them with novel experiences, but this is equally easy for solitary mothers and those that live socially in families. Can adult cats benefit from living socially by learning from one another? We know little about this intriguing possibility, but one obscure experiment done more than 70 years ago suggests that they can. Several six-month-old cats were given the opportunity to obtain a bowl of food placed on a turntable out of their reach. A ratchet under the turntable ensured that a single swipe of a paw was not sufficient to bring the food within reach, and it took many sessions before the cats had learned that careful manipulation with one paw was needed to pull the food within reach. However, two cats that had never used the apparatus themselves, but had watched their sisters successfully rotate the turntable and eat the food, both solved the problem in less than a minute. It was probably no coincidence that it was sisters, not unrelated cats, that found it easy to learn from one another. Transmission of skills between family members may be mutually beneficial and give family groups an advantage over solitary cats that can learn only by trial and error. Whether young cats ever learn much from cats that are not members of their family is doubtful. Underlying distrust probably focuses their minds exclusively on staying out of trouble, overriding any curiosity about what another cat is doing. However, within a close-knit family group, younger members may benefit from watching how older, more experienced members of the group solve everyday problems. Because cats hunt alone, this is most likely to occur when the cats are in their shared core territory, perhaps when scavenging for food or interacting with people. Although we may logically assume that cats began to live in family groups only since they started to associate with humans, wild cats also may have, or may have had, this ability. The formation of a group of cats seems to have only one essential requirement: a reliable source of food that can feed more than one cat and her litter of kittens. The only felid that has consistently achieved this leap is the lion, which has adopted group hunting as a way to prey on large animals. However, other felids might once have lived in small groups, even without developing this additional skill. Before man's domination of the environment in the 20th century led to the depletion of the small cats and their favorite prey, wild cats might occasionally have lived in colonies. Several accounts left by early 20th century European explorers of Africa give tantalizing glimpses of this possibility. Willoughby Prescott Lowe, one of the last noted collectors of animals for the British Natural History Museum, describes a specimen he took from near Darfur in the Sudan in 1921. "I trapped an interesting cat near Fasher. Something like a domestic cat, but very different in coloration. The curious thing is that they live in colonies in holes in the open plain. All the holes are close together, just like a rabbit warren. I'm told they are very vocal. Anyhow, a cat with these habits was quite new to me. They feed on gerbils, which swarm everywhere, and the ground is always a mass of holes." 10 years later, on an expedition in the Ahaggar Mountains in the center of the Sahara Desert, Lowe again recorded colonies of wild cats living in burrows previously dug by fennec foxes. Both these cats looked like typical African wild cats, but their sociability need not have come from their wildcat ancestry. The DNA of apparent wildcats from farther south in Africa, and also from the Middle East, reveals extensive interbreeding between domestic and wild cats. What Lowe saw may have been colonies of hybrids, which had retained the domestic cat's ability to live in family groups while outwardly appearing to be wild cats. That social groups of these Felis libica have been recorded so infrequently suggests that when they do occur, their social skills may have originated in previous interbreeding with domestic cats. The switch from solitary animal to social living requires a quantum leap in communication skills. For an animal as well armored and suspicious as a cat, a simple tiff between sisters might well escalate into a family bust-up, unless, that is, a system of signaling evolved that allowed each cat to assess the other's moods and intentions. And this, it seems, is precisely what happened. For domestic cats, my own research has shown that the key signal is the familiar straight-up tail. In cat colonies, when two cats are working out whether to approach each other, one usually raises its tail vertically. If the other is happy to reciprocate, it usually raises its tail also, and the two will walk up to each other. If the second cat does not raise its tail, and the first is feeling especially bold, it may approach nevertheless, but obliquely. If the second cat then turns away, the first cat occasionally meows to attract its attention, among the very few occasions when feral cats meow. Otherwise, the first cat lowers its tail and heads off in another direction, presumably judging that the other is not in the mood to be friendly. Hesitation can be risky. My research team documented instances when a cat moving in the wrong direction, even with its tail upright, was chased off by another, usually larger cat, determined to be left alone. Observations such as these do not prove conclusively that the upright tail is a signal. It could conceivably be something that happens when two friendly cats meet, with no meaning for either. To isolate the raised tail from everything else that a real cat might do to indicate its intentions, we cut life-size silhouettes of cats from black paper and stuck them to the baseboard of cat owners' houses. When the resident cat saw an upright tail silhouette, it usually approached and sniffed it. When the silhouette had a horizontal tail, the cat backed away. Footnote: this silhouette trick fooled most cats only once. The second one they came across elicited almost no reaction at all. End of note. The tail-up signal has almost certainly evolved since domestication, arising from a posture kittens use when greeting their mothers. Adults of other cat species raise their tails only when they are about to spray urine, simply for hygiene. A few individuals of Felis libica in zoos do raise their tails when about to rub on their keeper's legs, but these, of course, could have some domestic cat in their ancestry. Adults of the other races of Felis silvestris do not raise their tails in greeting, but their kittens do hold their tails upright when approaching their mother. No one has tested whether this holds any significance for the mother, so we do not know whether kittens do this as a signal or whether it's purely incidental. Therefore, it seems most plausible that the upright tail evolved from a posture into a signal during the early stages of domestication. This would have required two changes in how cats organize their behavior. One, for adult cats to perform the kitten's raised tail posture when approaching other cats, and two, for other cats to recognize instinctively that a cat with its tail raised is not a threat. Footnote: researchers think that the retention of juvenile characteristics into adulthood, referred to as neoteny, was a major factor in the domestication of many animals, especially the dog. For example, at first sight, the skull of a Pekingese is nothing like that of its ancestor, the wolf, but in fact, it is roughly the same shape as the skull of a wolf fetus. Although the domestic cat's body has not been neotenized, some of its behavior may have been, including the upright tail and some other social signals. End of note. Once both these changes had occurred, the posture would have evolved into a signal, one that enabled adult cats to live in close proximity to each other with less risk of quarreling. Once an exchange of tail-ups has established that both cats are happy to approach each other, one of two things occurs. Which of the two seems to be influenced by both the cat's moods and the relationship they have with each other? If the cats are in the middle of doing something else, and or one cat is significantly older or larger than the other, they usually walk up to or alongside each other. Then, keeping their tails upright, they come into physical contact and rub their heads, flanks, or tails, or a combination of all of them, on each other before separating and walking on. Any two cats from the same group will perform this occasionally, but it is typically performed by female cats greeting males, and young cats of either sex greeting females. The precise significance of this rubbing ritual is still unclear. The physical contact in itself may reinforce the friendship between the two participants and thereby keep the group together, a ritual that counteracts the natural tendency of cats to regard others as rivals, not allies. The act of rubbing together also inevitably transfers scent from one cat to the other, so repeated rubbing could cause a family odor to build up. We know that some of the cat's carnivore relatives exchange scent via rubbing rituals. For example, badgers from the same set create a clan odor by rubbing their back ends together, exchanging scent between their subcaudal glands, wax-filled pockets of skin that lie just beneath their tails. Cats may not deliberately exchange odour when they rub on one another. If they were doing so, they would likely concentrate their rubs on scent-producing areas of their bodies, such as the glands at the corners of their mouths, which they use to scent mark prominent objects in their territories. But they generally don't. As such, the rubbing ritual may be mainly tactile, a reaffirmation of trust between two animals, which, by accumulation, reduces the likelihood of the group splintering apart. The other social exchange that can follow the tail-up signal is mutual licking, or allo-grooming. Cats spend much time licking their coats, so it is hardly surprising that when two cats lie down side by side, they often lick each other. Moreover, they tend to groom the top of the other cat's head and between the shoulders. These are areas that the supplest of cats finds hardest to groom for itself. Not impossible, of course, since cats with no grooming buddy use their wrists to wipe those areas and then in turn lick their wrists. And all cats use this method to clean their mouths after eating. One interpretation of allo-grooming holds that it is entirely accidental. Two cats sitting together groom those areas that smell the least clean, oblivious that those areas belong to another cat. However, we know that allo-grooming has a profound social significance in many other animals, especially in primates, in which it has been linked with pair bonding, the building of coalitions, and in reconciliations between family members who have recently quarreled. In cats, allo-grooming likely performs the same function as mutual rubbing, cementing an amicable relationship. Consistent with this is the observation that in large groups of cats consisting of more than one family, most allo-grooming takes place between relatives. Some evidence shows that allo-grooming does reduce conflict. In artificial colonies, such as those established by cat rescue organizations, aggression is often much less prevalent than might be expected from tensions caused by forcing unrelated animals to live together. Significantly, however, allo-grooming is common. Moreover, the most aggressive cats often do most of the allo-grooming, implying that licking another cat may be an apology for a recent loss of temper. Alternatively, a cat that allows itself to be groomed does so because it remembers that it was recently attacked by the same cat, and being groomed is much more pleasant than being bitten. This latter interpretation conceives allo-grooming as an alternative to aggression, so placing it in a dominance framework whereby one animal controls another's activities. Some scientists have proposed that cat societies are indeed structured according to dominance hierarchies, with larger, stronger, more experienced and more aggressive cats imposing themselves on those that are smaller, younger or more timid. The dominance concept has long been applied to domestic dogs and their ancestor, the grey wolf, but has recently been the source of much controversy. Most biologists now agree that while groups of dogs and wolves may sometimes appear to establish and maintain hierarchies using aggression and threat, they do so only under extreme circumstances when their natural tendencies to form amicable relationships have been thwarted. As with dogs, the apparent formation of a dominance hierarchy in cats may be a result of external pressures. Social tensions arise when unrelated cats live together, either in one of the large outdoor colonies that form around large concentrations of food, such as fishing villages, or in a household with many unrelated cats obtained at different times from multiple sources. No hierarchies are apparent in small one-family colonies, or indeed within family groups that form part of a larger colony. Cat society is not as highly evolved as canid society. Cat society is matriarchal. Each unit begins with one female and her offspring, and if enough food is available on a regular basis, her daughters will stay with her. And when they produce litters of their own, care of the kittens will be shared between them. This situation is more equitable and probably less highly evolved than occurs in wolf society, in which juveniles assist their parents in raising the next generation of cubs, but refrain from breeding themselves that year. Footnote: feral dogs, the direct descendants of wolves, show little of their ancestors' social sophistication. although groups of males and females band together to form packs that share common territory, all the adult females attempt to breed, and most of the puppies are cared for only by their mother, although occasionally two litters may be pooled, and some records show fathers bringing food to their litters. End of note. Moreover, and in contrast to the situation in the wolf pack, which typically consists of roughly equal numbers of males and females, male cats do not help with raising kittens. In some colonies, female cats have been observed as super affectionate toward the resident male, presumably the father of their most recent litters, possibly regarding him as a first line of defense against infanticide by other males. A typical small cat colony might thus consist of a mother, her grown-up daughters, their most recent litters of kittens, and one or two tomcats. Family groups cannot expand ad infinitum, of course, because they will inevitably outstrip their food supply. Young males start to leave their colonies at about 6 months of age, sometimes maintaining a shadowy existence around the fringes for a year or two, but eventually forging out on their own to look for females elsewhere, thereby incidentally preventing inbreeding. Among females, relationships become increasingly strained as they must compete for space and food. Any major event, perhaps the death of the matriarch, can trigger a breakdown in the relationship between some of the cats. Aggression increases, and the once peaceful colony may irrevocably split into two or more groups. The members of the minority group may be forced to leave the area entirely, something that will have serious consequences for them. Thereafter, deprived of the resources around which the original colony formed, they are unlikely to raise many offspring to maturity. In this way, over the years, the central family group will usually persist, but the more successful it becomes, the more likely that some of its female members will become outcasts. The composition of the central group is also likely to be disrupted, both by other cats trying to get access to the food and shelter the original group are monopolizing, and also by humans, who often attempt to cull the cats as their numbers rise. As a result, cat society rarely remains stable for more than a few years at a stretch. The benefits of cooperation, while not powerful enough to produce sophisticated social behavior, have evidently been sufficient for a limited range of social communication to have evolved. The tail-up posture, mutual rubbing, and allo-grooming. In the absence of evidence to the contrary, we can reasonably assume that this change did not start until cats began their association with humankind some 10,000 years ago. If so, it has happened remarkably quickly, but not impossibly so. Although we usually conceive of evolution by natural selection operating over timescales of hundreds of thousands or even millions of years, examples of exceptionally rapid change or explosive speciation have recently been documented in wild animals that have stumbled on new and hitherto unexploited environments such that completely new species can emerge in just a few hundred generations. Footnote: one well-researched instance of explosive speciation is the cichlid fish of Lake Victoria, which, despite now being the world's largest tropical lake, was dry land only 15,000 years ago. Today it contains many hundreds of cichlid species, none of which are found in any of the other African Great Lakes, and most of which have evolved in the 14,000 years since the lake last filled with water. See, for example, Walter Salzberger, Tanya Mack, Eric Verhagen, and Axel Meyer, Out of Tanganyika, Genesis, Explosive Speciation, Key Innovations, and Phylogeography of the Haplochromine Cichlid Fishes, BMC Evolutionary Biology 5, 2005, 17. End of note. Furthermore, if the tail-up signal has evolved from a posture performed by kittens into a sign whose meaning is recognized by every adult cat, then it is the only documented example of a new signal having evolved as a consequence of domestication. Every other documented domestic species communicates using a subset of signals performed by its wild ancestor. Male domestic cats, in contrast to females, appear largely untouched by domestication, apart from their capacity to become socialized to people when they are kittens. Each one precisely resembles Rudyard Kipling's cat that walked by himself. Unlike lions and cheetahs, male domestic cats do not form alliances with one another, remaining resolutely competitive for the whole of their lives, which, as a result, are often both eventful and rather short. Female cats and neutered males try to avoid one another when they can, but when two males meet and neither wishes to back down, their fighting can be brutal. Listen to the section Bluff and Bluster at the end of this chapter. Because most owners have their cats neutered, mature tomcats are something of a rarity in Western society. Few people keep them as pets, and many of those who try to do so are subsequently discouraged by the pungency of the urine tomcats spray around the garden, or worse, the house, by the wounds they receive from stronger, more experienced tomcats in the neighborhood, and by their week-long absences as they journey off in search of receptive females. Most owners of male cats never get to this point, taking the advice of their veterinarian to have their kitten neutered before testosterone starts to kick in at about 6 months of age. Male cats that have been neutered during their first year behave much more like females than males, and are usually as sociable toward other cats as a female would be under the same circumstances. That is, most will remain friendly toward other cats that they have known since birth, usually but not necessarily their blood relations, and a few will be even more outgoing. Tomcat behavior gives us insight on how the cat may be evolving today. A tomcat's main goal is to compete for the attention of as many females as possible. As a consequence, wildcat toms evolved to be 15 to 40% heavier than females. This is also true of domestic cats today. Tomcat's physicality appears to have been affected little by domestication. By definition, half the genes in each new generation of kittens comes from their fathers. Because successful tomcats can mate with many females over the course of a lifetime, those tomcats that leave the most offspring have a disproportionate effect on the next generation. Most owners of unneutered female cats allow them to mate with any tomcat in the neighborhood. So the decision over which tomcats leave the most offspring is usually determined by the cats themselves and not by people. The tactics tomcats employ to maximize their chances of successfully mating are affected by how many females live nearby. Where females are widely dispersed, as with wildcats and rural domestic cats, males try to defend large territories that overlap with those of as many females as possible, typically three or four. Even allowing that tomcats are larger than females, the amount of available food in such large territories is far more than they need, but their primary goal is access to females, not nourishment. Inevitably, there are not enough females for all males to monopolize more than one female. Male and female cats are born in roughly equal numbers, so some tomcats, usually the younger ones, must adopt a different strategy, that of roaming around, trying to find unclaimed females while avoiding bumping into those that are established territory holders. This overtly competitive system inevitably breaks down when large colonies of cats form around an abundant source of food. Although tomcats' tactics seem to have evolved prior to domestication, when all females were solitary and lived in separate territories, there appears to have been no great need for males to change their behavior when females began to live in small family groups, attracted by the fairly modest concentrations of food stemming from human activity. This arrangement continues to this day, for example, on farms that can support just a handful of cats. In places where scores of females are concentrated into one area, fishing ports, towns with many outdoor restaurants, or where several feral cat feeders operate together, no single male, however strong and fierce, could succeed in monopolizing several females, or even one. In these situations, there is a build-up of large colonies that include both males and females, some of which act on their own and others cooperating in family groups. Each male is essentially in competition with all the others for the attention of the females, but as we have seen, they somehow manage mostly to avoid the overt fighting that occurs around smaller colonies. Moreover, males in these large groups are often even less aggressive when some of the females become receptive to mating, almost as if they knew they needed to be on their best behavior for a female to accept them as a mate. Most of the time, female cats avoid contact with males, particularly those they don't know well, presumably for fear of being attacked. There are some exceptions. In the small, single-family colony that David MacDonald studied, all the females behaved affectionately toward the resident tomcat, possibly hoping that he would defend their kittens against any marauding males attempting to take over the group. Of course, this antipathy changed as the female begins to come into season. When she is in the pro-estrus phase, the few days prior to actual mating, she becomes both more attractive to males and more tolerant of them, although at this stage she will not allow more than fleeting contact. She becomes more restless than usual and repeatedly deposits scent by rubbing against prominent objects in her territory. If there are no males in the vicinity, she begins to roam away from her usual haunts, scent marking and uttering a characteristic guttural cry as she goes. She probably also advertises her imminent willingness to mate by changes in her scent that may be detected by males as far away as several miles downwind. Then, as estrus approaches, she begins to roll over and over on the ground, purring all the while, interspersed with bouts of stretching, kneading the ground with her claws, and more restless scent marking. By this time, several males are usually in attendance. While she now lets them approach, she does not allow them to mount her, fighting off any that try with her claws and teeth. As each male attempts to maximize the numbers of kittens they sire, each female tries to maximize the genetic quality of the limited number of kittens she can produce in a lifetime. She uses her courtship period to select between the males that she has attracted. She may already know something about them from the scent marks they have deposited in her territory. See the section That Catty Smell at the end of this chapter. But she can make a more balanced assessment from observing their behavior toward one another and toward other females. She may then decide, or be forced, to accept more than one for mating. As her hormones take her into full estrus, the female's behavior changes abruptly. In between bouts of rolling, she crouches with her head close to the ground, treading with hind legs partially extended and holding her tail to one side, inviting the males to copulate. The boldest of those in attendance then mounts her, grasping the scruff of her neck in his teeth. A few seconds later, in apparent contradiction to her invitation, she screams in pain, turns on him and drives him away, spitting and scratching. This abrupt change of mood is brought about by the pain she undoubtedly experiences during copulation. The male cat's penis is equipped with 120 to 150 sharp spines, designed to trigger her ovulation. Cats, unlike humans, do not ovulate spontaneously, but require this stimulus. Happily, she appears to forget this discomfort quickly. Within a few minutes, she displays herself to the males all over again, a cycle that continues at a gradually decreasing rate for a day or two. Her receptive period over, she removes herself from the area and the males disperse. If she has not become pregnant, she comes into season again every couple of weeks until she successfully conceives. Much of this complex ritual evolved long before domestication, when every female cat lived in her own territory, perhaps several miles away from the nearest male. Scientists think that the female's delayed ovulation evolved to give her plenty of time to locate a mate, since cats, unlike many carnivores, do not usually form pair bonds. This drawn-out courtship would be unnecessary if only one male was attracted at a time. Instead, it seems designed for the female first to attract several males, presuming that there are a few good ones in the area, and then to observe them for many hours or even days, so she can gauge which is likely to provide the best genes for her kittens, which is all she can hope to get from their father, since paternal care is unknown in cats. The optimum strategy for males probably changed once man began to provide cats with food at the beginning of the journey to domestication. Female territories became smaller and reliably focused on prime hunting areas around granaries, rich areas for scavenging, and any places where people deliberately provided food. It then became efficient for males to compete all year for territories that encompassed those of several females, and to monopolize those females when they came into season. Males that adopted the old-fashioned tactic of roaming widely, expecting to pick up the scent of receptive females by chance, were likely less successful. The few studies that have investigated male mating patterns show that the most successful males are often those that combine these tactics, staying at home when their own females were likely coming into season, but also making brief forays to other groups and solitary females nearby in the hope of achieving successful mating there also. Such a no-holds-barred lifestyle takes its toll, however. Males are rarely strong or experienced enough to compete effectively until they are 3 years old, and many do not survive beyond 6 or 7, the victims of road traffic accidents or infections spreading from wounds incurred in fights. When many cats of both sexes all live in one small area, tomcats are forced to change their tactics. Monopolizing even one female risks becoming unprofitable, since while his back is turned to deal with one challenger, another may have sneaked in and successfully mated with his female. Under these circumstances, the toms appear to accept that each female will inevitably copulate with several males. Instead of attempting to attach themselves to any one or two individuals, they try to mate with as many females as possible. This strategy probably did not evolve specifically to allow cats to live at such very high densities. Indeed, such high-density cat colonies probably occur rarely in nature, although they attract a disproportionate amount of attention from scientists where they do, given how convenient they are to study. Instead, males that grow up in such large groups probably learn which tactics work best, or perhaps more likely, which tactics should be avoided because they risk injury, from a combination of personal experience and observation of how older males in the colony conduct themselves. They may also use this knowledge as the older males become too infirm to compete. In the few large colonies that have been studied, young males rarely emigrate, the opposite of the situation in smaller colonies. This situation may result in some inbreeding, given the enhanced risk that a male that remains in his family group will mate with a close female relative. Still, immigration by males and females from outside, attracted by abundant resources, usually a cluster of dedicated cat feeders, prevents such potential inbreeding from becoming debilitating. For some time, scientists have known that the coat colors of the kittens in some litters can be accounted for only if some had one father and some another. If a female attracts several males, she will sometimes refuse all but one. Often, however, she will choose to mate with two or even more. Multiple paternity within a single litter is therefore always a possibility, but we cannot reliably detect it by coat color alone, especially in large colonies where the males may all look similar. DNA testing has enabled much more reliable examination of how females' opportunities for choices at mating translate into actual choices of fathers for her kittens. In small colonies with one resident male, females do not appear to have exerted much choice at the time of mating. Only about one litter in five exhibits DNA from any other male. The females may, however, have settled on their choice of male long beforehand, when they allowed him to live alongside them. Alternatively, he may simply have imposed himself on them, giving them little option but to wait for another, larger male to turn up if they had doubts about the quality of his genes. At present, we have little scientific evidence either way. In larger colonies, females not only mate with several males in sequence, but the large majority of their litters also contain the DNA of more than one of these. The females may be exerting some choice. They sometimes show a preference for males from outside their group, thus preventing inbreeding, and also those males from their own group, which are able to defend the largest territories. The female's practice of offering herself to several males one after the other may have another purpose, protecting her future offspring from infanticide. Each male has observed her being mated by others, but cannot know which of her kittens are his and which not. Likewise, since each of the larger males has mated with several females, none has any incentive to kill any litters. Most urban males today are faced with a new and different problem: how to locate females that are capable of breeding. Nowadays, an increasing proportion of pet cats are neutered before they are old enough to reproduce. Animal welfare charities not only promote the spaying of all females before they have even one litter, they also attempt to seek out and neuter the feral colonies that remain. The urban tomcat is unlikely to locate, let alone defend, a harem of reproductive females. In built-up environments, most tomcats probably adopt the same roaming lifestyle as their wild forebears, hoping to stumble on a young female whose owners have delayed spaying either because they want her to have a litter or simply because they are unaware that today's reliable nutrition enables females to mature more quickly than ever before and can come into season when they're as young as 6 months old. Judging by my admittedly casual observations, tomcats seem unable to distinguish between neutered females that form the large majority in many towns and cities, and the few mostly young females that are still reproductively intact. Roaming toms still visited annually in late winter to check out my two females 10 years after they had been neutered, having produced 1 and 3 litters respectively. Spayed females may be difficult to distinguish from intact females between seasons, certainly not by the way they behave, and possibly not even by their odor, to which tomcats are presumably very sensitive. Urban toms thus face a needle-in-a-haystack problem. They are surrounded by hundreds of females, only an otherwise indistinguishable few of which will ever present them with the opportunity to sire any kittens. The tomcats must therefore roam as widely as possible, endlessly straining their senses for the yowl and odor of the rare female that is coming into season. Such toms are shadowy animals. Some are theoretically owned, though their owners rarely see them, and many feral. Because they make themselves inconspicuous, except when they have located a prize female, there are probably far more of them than most people realize. When it first became possible to obtain a cat's DNA fingerprint from just a few hairs, my research team attempted to locate every litter born in homes in a couple of districts of Southampton, UK. From what we'd read, we expected to find that just a few dominant tomcats had sired most of the litters in each district. Instead, we found that out of more than 70 kittens, virtually all litters had different fathers, only one of which we were able to locate. We found no evidence for littermates having different fathers, which implied that most estrous females had attracted only one male. Apparently, by inadvertently hiding the few reproductive queens that remain in a sea of spayed females, the widespread adoption of neutering is making it difficult for even the fiercest, strongest tomcat to do much more than search at random, thereby giving all the males in the area an even chance of reproducing. Cats of both sexes have shown remarkable flexibility in adapting their sexual behavior to the various scenarios that we humans have, over the course of time, imposed on them. One reason that they have coped so well is simply that female domestic cats are very fecund, capable of producing as many as a dozen kittens per year. Even when conditions for reproduction are difficult, most free-living female cats will leave at least 2 or 3 descendants, enough to maintain the population, even if many of her litters do not survive to adulthood. Cat society has even adapted to life at high densities, despite origins in territorial rivalry. Logically, that heritage should result in mayhem, totally unsuitable for raising defenseless infants. Females seem to have resolved this problem by accepting the advances of several males each time they come into season, thereby making each male uncertain which kittens are his, and so banishing all thoughts of infanticide. When cat colonies are smaller, females choose to live in small family groups and may bond with only one male, whom they accept as being both the most suitable father for their kittens and the most effective at driving away marauding rivals. When they are deprived of the company of their female relatives, either because food is insufficient for more than one cat, or due to human intervention, females are equally capable of bringing up litters without any assistance whatsoever. This remarkable flexibility must have contributed to the cat adapting to such a wide range of niches. Male cats have also adapted remarkably well, though in a different way to females. Since in theory one male cat can sire many hundreds of kittens, the number of males in any one area is never likely to be the factor that limits the size of the cat population. Nevertheless, each individual male has no interest in the survival of his species, only in producing as many offspring of his own as he can. When breeding females are few and far between, a male must search as widely as possible for mating opportunities, pausing only to grab enough food to keep him on the move. If he can be the first, and ideally only male, to reach a female at the crucial moment, she is unlikely to be choosy about his quality. If he happens to be in an area where there are several females, and some of these live in groups, it may benefit him to form a pair bond or harem, although this seems not to inhibit him from searching for additional females elsewhere, when he judges that he can get away with it. He will also keep an eye out for other groups of females that he might try to take over in the future, and it is most likely males that are in this frame of mind that commit the occasional act of infanticide. However, if he finds himself living in a vast colony with many potential rivals as well as many potential mates, he will learn to curb his natural aggression, this being the only sensible strategy that will allow him to father some kittens without sustaining mortal injury. These tales of sex and violence seem far removed from the cozy world of cat and devoted owner, but these are, of course, the ways in which the next generation of cats is created. Only about 15% of cats in the Western world come from planned mating, the great majority arising from liaisons initiated by the cats themselves. Since most pets are now neutered before they become sexually mature, most cat owners are only dimly aware of the shenanigans that undoctored cats get up to. Spayed females behave as if permanently stuck between cycles of reproductive activity, and males that are neutered young never develop characteristic tomcat behavior, instead behaving more like neutered females. Tolerance of other cats is improved by neutering, but only up to a point, and family bonds established between brothers and sisters or mothers and their offspring are still apparent if the cats continue to live in the same house. Unrelated cats that are brought together by their owners to live in the same household, or that meet on the boundaries between adjacent gardens, often still display the natural antipathy that they have inherited from their wild ancestors. However, unlike those ancestors, today's domestic cats can also establish close bonds with humans, bringing a new dimension to their social networks. Bluff and bluster. When two rival cats meet, each will try to persuade the other to back down without either having to resort to physical contact. Cats are too well armed to risk fighting unless this is unavoidable. They therefore resort to adopting postures that attempt to persuade their opponent that they are bigger than they really are. Each cat will draw itself up to its full height, turn partially sideways, and make its hair stand on end, all designed to make its profile seem as big as possible. Of course, since both cats do this, neither gains any advantage, but that also means that neither can risk not performing this display to its maximum extent. The only clue that such a cat may be less than confident about winning is when it pulls its ears toward the back of its head. The ears are very vulnerable to being damaged in a fight, as testified by how ragged they can become even when they belong to the most successful of toms. At the same time, each cat tries to add to the general effect by uttering a variety of calls, each designed to enhance the general impression that it is not to be trifled with. These include guttural yowls and snarls, violent spitting, and especially low-pitched growls. The lower the sound, the larger the voice box must be, and therefore, by implication, the larger the cat. These vocalizations usually continue, even if the visual posturing fails and actual fighting begins. Cats, lacking the dog's rich repertoire of visual signals, find it difficult to signal an intention to back down. Fights usually end with one cat fleeing, with the victor in hot pursuit. If neither cat wishes to fight, one will gradually adopt a much less threatening posture, with its body crouched and its ears flattened, and then attempt to creep slowly away, frequently looking over its shoulder to check that the other cat is not about to launch an attack. That catty smell. Female cats can be very choosy when it comes to selecting a father for their kittens, so tomcats need to advertise just how successful they are, preferably before they ever actually meet the female. They probably do this through the pungent smell of their urine, repellent to our noses, but presenting vital information to a cat's. To make sure that this smell is picked up by as many other cats as possible, the tom doesn't squat down before urinating, as other cats do, but instead backs toward a prominent object, such as a gatepost, raises his tail, stands on the tips of his hind toes, and sprays his urine onto the object as high up as he can. The powerful odor of a tomcat's urine, much stronger than that of a female's or a neutered male's, is caused by a mixture of sulfur-containing molecules called thiols, similar to those that give garlic its characteristic smell. Footnote: our noses are particularly sensitive to thiols. Minute traces are added to natural gas, which in itself is completely odorless, to make it easier to detect leaks. End of note. These do not appear in the urine until it has actually been voided and come into contact with the air. Otherwise, the tomcat himself would smell as if he ate garlic every day. In the bladder, they are stored in an odorless form as an amino acid that was first discovered in cats and hence was given the name phelanin. Phelanin, in turn, is generated in the bladder by a protein called cauxin. In tomcat urine, the signal is probably not the protein, cauxin, but the phelanin, which is made from one of two amino acids, cysteine and methionine, both of which contain the sulfur atom necessary for the eventual generation of the pungent odor. Cats cannot make either of these amino acids for themselves, meaning that the amount of phelanin they can make is determined by the amount of high-quality protein in their diets. In a wild cat, this is in turn determined by how successful a hunter that cat is. Thus, the smellier the urine mark is, the more phelanin it contains, indicating that the cat that made the mark must be good at obtaining food. The urine mark must also contain information about the identity of the cat that produced it. Otherwise, a female could not know which of the several males in front of her was the best hunter. So far, scientists have not investigated this part of the message, but it is presumably other than the pungent sulfur compounds. Other species use the vomeronasal organ to detect individual odor signatures. However repellent to us, the cat urine odor is a genuine badge of quality. A sickly or incompetent male is simply unable to get enough food to make its urine pungent. The evolution of this signal was therefore probably driven by the females, which selected males based on how smelly their urine was. Males unable to make phelanin, however good their diet, would not have been favored by females. Using these criteria, tomcats whose owners feed them high-quality commercial food are technically cheats, but this has happened too recently to have had any effect on female behavior. And anyway, I guess nobody has told them yet.